The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And a Happy New Year to you, and welcome to our program for this week. We'll be reading from the Week magazine, dated December 30th, 2011, through January 6th, 2012, a combined issue for the beginning of the year. Our first item this week is entitled, The Implications of Kim Jong-il's Death. What Happened? The death of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il 2 weeks ago left neighboring Asian nations on high alert amid fears that the world's most reclusive and repressive regime might now implode violently or lash out in a show of strength. The 69-year-old dear leader died of a sudden heart attack over the weekend 2 weeks ago, plunging the country into a state of mourning marked by histrionic public displays of wailing citizens collapsing in grief. Kim's son, Kim Jong-un, 27, has since been named great successor by the state-run media. But observers suspect the nuclear-armed country might shift to collective rule under the untested younger Kim, his 65-year-old uncle Jack Song Chaek, and select leaders of the country's powerful military. The U.S. and South Korea put their military forces in the area on high alert out of concern that North Korea might flex its muscles in the wake of Kim Jong-il's death. Under the dictator's rule, the country pursued a bellicose military-first strategy, procuring and testing nuclear weapons in breach of international law, and launching periodic attacks on South Korean ships and territory. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that if the new leadership chose the path of improving relations with its neighbors and respecting the rights of its people, the U.S. would help North Korea usher in a new era of peace, prosperity, and lasting security. Now here's what the editorial said. Kim Jong-il was an easy dictator to laugh at, said the New Republic, with his ever-present sunglasses, his platform shoes, and his obsession with American celebrities like Michael Jordan and Elizabeth Taylor. But no single person who lived in the last few decades has inflicted as much suffering and cruelty on others. While Kim and the communist leadership wallowed in luxuries, up to 2 million North Koreans died in the famine of the 1990s, and malnutrition and starvation are still widespread. As many as 200,000 political prisoners suffer incomprehensible deprivation and brutality in Kim's prison camps, where they sometimes are forced to watch family members being butchered. Kim's brutal regime was enabled by the self-interested calculations of surrounding powers, said the Washington Post. Prosperous South Korea feared the crippling cost of reunification if its northern neighbor failed. China did not want a pro-Western Korea on its doorstep, and the U.S. always had higher priorities than the welfare of North Koreans. In the strategic decision-making to come, let's not ignore the fate of the enslaved North Korean people. Now here's what the columnist had to say. A collapse of North Korea is a real possibility, said John Bolton in the Wall Street Journal. That would be dangerous, unleashing hundreds of thousands of refugees and raising the possibility that the regime's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons could be dispersed to terrorists. But Kim's death is also an enormous opportunity to peacefully reunite the two Koreas if the Obama administration plays it smart. Our policy should be regime change, gradual and patient if necessary, said Dan Blumenthal in NationalReview.com. The Kim dynasty is too dangerous to leave in place. Actually, Washington is powerless over what happens next, said Victor Cha in the New York Times. North Korea is now an economic basket case propped up by China, and it is Beijing that will determine the country's immediate future. Its rulers like having a weak communist state on its border instead of a reunified democratic Korea. But to keep North Korea from collapsing, China may have to effectively adopt it as a province. No major changes will occur right away as North Korea turns inward, said Michael Green in the Washington Post. But by the mid-2012, the regime's belligerent military leaders will assert their influence over the younger Kim's agenda. They truly believe they can use their nuclear weapons to make demands of the U.S. as an equal nuclear state. As crazy as he might have been, Kim Jong-il knew when to threaten and when to back off. No one is confident, however, that the younger Kim knows how to play the same dangerous game without crossing the line. The next article is Egypt's Women Rise Up. Video footage of Egyptian soldiers beating and stripping female demonstrators spurred thousands of Egyptian women to return to Cairo's Tahrir Square this past week, shouting, "The women of Egypt are a red line." The most widely distributed video showed soldiers ripping off a woman's traditional robe and headscarf to reveal her blue bra, then stomping on her chest. This systematic degradation of Egyptian women dishonors the revolution, disgraces the state and its uniform, and is not worthy of a great people, said Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The attacks on female demonstrators came during a week of street fighting between troops and protesters, calling for the military government to cede power to the parliament currently being elected in multi-round polling. Hundreds of civilians were wounded and more than a dozen killed in the clashes. The military's brutalization of women isn't new, said Adolf Soev in the London Guardian. The regime of Hosni Mubarak used to insinuate that females who took part in street protests wanted to be groped. The idea spread, and harassment of women in the streets rose to epidemic levels. But men and women protested together to oust Mubarak earlier this year, and the military clearly hasn't grasped that we are still united. The women's march this week was joined by thousands of men who formed a human shield around their sisters. The video of the women in the blue bra, or the woman in the blue bra, has utterly destroyed the military's reputation. Maybe it's time to hit the military where it hurts, in the wallet, said the New York Times in an editorial. If the army continues to attack the Egyptian people, the Obama administration should cut the $2 billion in annual aid sent to Egypt to show that it will not enable such behavior. It's easy to blame the military for the current chaos, said Stephen Cook in Foreign Policy, but the generals have had a lot of help. Egypt's revolutionaries, stuck in protest mode, have failed to do the hard work of political organizing. They simply throw rocks, even as the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood prevails in the ongoing elections. The chance for positive change is fading as Egyptians tire of Tahrir's Frankenstein monster, where there is no leadership, no moral force, no common cause, and no sense of decency. The next item from the main story section of the Week magazine is payroll tax cut in limbo. With the clock ticking, Congress deadlocked this past week over extending a payroll tax cut affecting 160 million Americans. House Republicans unexpectedly rejected a bipartisan Senate compromise that would have extended the tax cut for 2 months beyond December 31 to buy time for talks on a longer-term agreement. House Speaker John Boehner rejected that short-term extension as an unacceptable stopgap and insisted that the Senate return to Washington from the holiday recess for more negotiations. President Obama responded by calling the Senate bill the only viable way to prevent a January 1 tax hike. Unless Congress acts before New Year's Day, payroll taxes will rise by 2%. Doctors will see a 27% cut in their Medicare reimbursements, and 2 million people will lose unemployment benefits. And as you know, this particular magazine was printed 2 weeks ago. They did extend it for the two-month period. The next item, the controversy of the week, Iraq. What was gained and what was lost? The last U.S. convoy rolled out of Iraq this week, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, and though the battle-weary troops were certainly glad to be heading home, no one even tried to use the word victory. Welcoming home soldiers at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, President Obama used the hedge term a moment of success and congratulated them on leaving behind an Iraq that is self-governing, that is inclusive, and that has enormous potential. But after 9 bloody years of war, some 4,500 U.S. troops dead, more than 33,000 wounded and maimed, and nearly $1 trillion spent, many Americans question whether our achievements in Iraq were worth the staggering cost. What did we really buy with all that blood and treasure, said Tony Karen in Time.com. No sooner had the last U.S. troops left Iraq than Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki ordered the arrest of Iraq's Sunni vice president because of an alleged bomb plot and sought to fire the Sunni deputy prime minister. Maliki may well be morphing into just another repressive sectarian dictator, Saddam Light, and the new Iraq we sacrificed so much to create faces a dark, divided future. Regardless of what happens now in Iraq, said Gary Kamiya in Salon.com, this war was one of the biggest mistakes in U.S. history. It was launched under false pretenses by the Bush administration, which exploited the nation's post-9/11 fears and manufactured evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Between 150,000 and 400,000 Iraqis were killed in the war and the bungled occupation and civil war that followed, and another 1.3 million were displaced from their homes. And what did their losses and ours produce? A destabilized Middle East, a newly emboldened and empowered Iran, and widespread hatred of the United States. You're wrong, said Oliver North in FoxNews.com. Our troops fought a long and difficult campaign, not for gold or oil or colonial conquest, but to offer others the hope of freedom. And they won, beating back violent challenges from insurgents and al-Qaeda jihadists. Iraq is still a dangerous place, make no mistake, but thanks to the patience and tenacity of the U.S. military, particularly in training up to 750,000 members of Iraq's own security forces, it is far safer to be a civilian in Iraq today than it is in Mexico. We're also leaving behind a giant U.S. embassy and 16,000 contractors and State Department personnel, which is not good news for the power-hungry Ayatollahs next door in Iran. Whether we won the war in Iraq remains an unsettled question, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. The Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds are still bitterly divided by issues of power, wealth, and identity. In coming months and years, we'll find out if the nation's political structures can handle those differences or if the factions will revive their armed struggles in the streets. Either way, said Andrew Bavich in The Washington Post, the Iraq War has provided a stark demonstration of the limits of American power. Bush and his aides launched the war to remind the world that despite 9/11, the U.S. still called the tune to which history marched. But in Iraq and Afghanistan, our matchless military could not create the liberal democracies of neocon fantasies. We leave these killing fields having buried our faith in permanent American supremacy in unmarked graves. That is this war's final legacy. And now we'll turn to the very popular section in The Week magazine called Good Week For and Bad Week For. It was a good week for the Christmas spirit after an anonymous donor dropped a solid gold Krugerrand worth about $1,700 into a Salvation Army kettle outside a Kmart near Atlanta. It was a good week for having a rich daddy after Russian billionaire Dmitry Rybolovlev paid $88 million for a 10-room New York City apartment that he's going to give to his 22-year-old college student daughter, Ekaterina Rybolovleva, as a place to crash when she visits the city. And it was a good week for John Bon Jovi, who is still alive despite a fake news release spread on Twitter reporting the rock star's death. To dispel the rumor, Bon Jovi, a New Jersey native, posted a picture of himself holding a note reading, "Heaven looks a lot like New Jersey." And it was a bad week for Pastor Greg Boutel of Fort Worth, whose Hyundai was badly damaged when a city streetlight fell on it. When he contacted Fort Worth officials for compensation for the $2,000 in damage, he was told it's an act of God. It was a bad week for, like, you know, after an annual survey by the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion found that whatever was the most annoying verbal filler in casual conversation for the third consecutive year. Like and you know were voted second and third most annoying, respectively. And it was a bad week for imitating Santa Claus after 18-year-old George Herrera of Stockton, California, tried to sneak into his house after his parents' curfew by climbing down the chimney. After he got stuck and wriggled for 90 minutes, firefighters were able to pull him to safety. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for the 2 weeks, December 30th and January 6th. Thanks for joining me today. Let's turn to the People section in the Week magazine now. The first item is entitled Grisham's Formula for Success. Success came abruptly to John Grisham, said Nicholas Rowe in the London Guardian. He was working as a small-town lawyer in Mississippi in 1991 when his second book, The Firm, became an overnight sensation. The legal thriller sold more than 7 million copies and was made into a blockbuster film starring Tom Cruise. It became popular so fast I was in a daze, he says. It is something you can't prepare for. But it was a chance meeting with a publishing executive that taught him to capitalize on his early success. A young executive with a big book chain said in passing, "The big guys come out every year." He meant the likes of Clancy, King, Crichton, Grisham explains. "At the time, I was halfway through the Pelican Brief and had no idea when it would be finished. But I went home, locked myself away for 60 days, and finished the book. It was published a year after The Firm. 1 year after that, I published The Client. The formula paid off." Throughout the 1990s, Grisham and Michael Crichton regularly exchanged the record for the most lucrative publishing and film rights deals. "We had a good thing going," he remembers happily. "I was told that Crichton's agents started asking for the X million Grisham got, plus a dollar. Money on the table." The next item, Sandusky's Mistaken Identity. It's been a tough couple of months for Jerry Sandusky and Peter Schrager in Esquire. The Baltimore football sportscaster shares all but a single letter of his name with another unrelated football personality, the one defensive coordinator at Penn State University accused of sexually abusing dozens of children. Jerry has been inundated with hate mail since the allegations became public and has to explain constantly that he is unrelated to his infamous namesake. "Every time I show my license, give a credit card, whatever, the person on the other end does a double take. The worst impact may be on his ability to network," he says. "I was on the field the day after the news broke, and Dick Ebersol, the former head of NBC Sports, an absolute giant in my field, walks by," he recalls. "So I extend my hand. Hey, I'm Jerry Sandusky." And I see him visibly flinch. Kind of a subtle flinch, but he definitely flinched. Sandusky explained the confusion, but Ebersol couldn't get away from me fast enough. He's tried to diffuse the problem with humor, thanking his late mother on Twitter for spelling his name, first name, with a G. "You can't always control what the universe drops in your lap, but you can control how you handle it." The next item, Mortensen's allergy to stardom. Viggo Mortensen can't stomach Hollywood actors, said Zoe Heller in the New York Times. Mortensen has spent the years since he played Aragorn in the Lord of the Rings trilogy acting in smaller projects like an adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's apocalyptic novel The Road and A Dangerous Method, in which he plays Sigmund Freud. When he's not making independent movies, he spends his time in art galleries or at the small publishing house he owns, rather than hanging out with the big stars at places where they'll be photographed. I see people doing that stuff, and to me it seems pathetic and ridiculous and kind of, well, humiliating, he says. He's particularly put off by actors who go through the motions once they're rich and famous, coming in late and leaving before scenes can be reshot. There's no excuse for that behavior, he says. You're tired? Come on, the crew isn't tired. The crew who got here 2 hours before you and who'll be here 2 hours after you leave and who are being paid, in many cases, 1/1000th of what you're being paid. That's why he avoids working in blockbuster films. Life is too short to work with idiots. Now we'll turn to the briefing section of the Week magazine for this week, and it's entitled, When Americans Banned Christmas. The original war on Christmas happened almost 400 years ago, courtesy of our Puritan forefathers. How did the first settlers celebrate Christmas? They didn't. The pilgrims who came to America in 1620 were strict Puritans with firm views on religious holidays, such as Christmas and Easter. Scripture did not name any holiday except the Sabbath, they argued, and the very concept of holy days implied that some days were not holy. They for whom all days are holy can have no holiday was a common Puritan maxim. Puritans were particularly contemptuous of Christmas, nicknaming it Fool's Tide, and banning their flock from any celebration of it throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. On the first December 25th, the settlers spent in Plymouth Colony, they worked in the fields as they would on any other day. The next year, a group of non-Puritan workmen caught celebrating Christmas with a game of stool ball, an early precursor of baseball, were punished by Governor William Bradford. My conscience cannot let you play while everybody else is out working, he told them. Why didn't Puritans like Christmas? They had several reasons, including the fact that it did not originate as a Christian holiday. The upper classes in ancient Rome celebrated December 25th as the birthday of the sun god Mithra. The date fell right in the middle of Saturnalia, a month-long holiday dedicated to food, drink, and revelry, and Pope Julius I is said to have chosen that day to celebrate Christ's birth as a way of co-opting the pagan rituals. Beyond that, the Puritans considered it historically inaccurate to place the Messiah's arrival on December 25th. They thought Jesus had been born sometime in September. So their objections were theological? Not exclusively. The main reason Puritans didn't like Christmas was that it was a raucously popular holiday in late medieval England. Each year, rich landowners would throw open their doors to the poor and give them food and drink as an act of charity. The poorest man in the parish was named the Lord of Misrule, and the rich would wait upon him at feasts that often descended into bawdy drunkenness. Such decadence never impressed religious purists. Men dishonor Christ more in the 12 days of Christmas, wrote the 16th century clergyman Hugh Latimer, than in all the 12 months besides. When did that view win out? Puritans in the English Parliament eliminated Christmas as a national holiday in 1645 amid widespread anti-Christmas sentiment. Settlers in New England went even further, outlawing Christmas celebrations entirely in 1659. Anyone caught shirking their work duties or feasting was forced to pay a significant penalty of 5 shillings. Christmas returned to England in 1660, but in New England it remained banned until the 1680s, when the Crown managed to exert greater control over its subjects in Massachusetts. In 1686, the royal governor of the colony, Sir Edmund Andros, sponsored a Christmas Day service at the Boston townhouse. Fearing a violent backlash from Puritan settlers, Andros was flanked by redcoats as he prayed and sang Christmas hymns. Did the Puritans finally relent? Not at all. They kept up their boycott of Christmas in Massachusetts for decades. Cotton Mather, New England's most influential religious leader, told his flock in 1712 that the feast of Christ's nativity is spent in reveling, dicing, carding, masking, and in all licentious liberty, by mad mirth, by long eating, by hard drinking, by lewd gaming, by rude reveling. European settlers in other American colonies continued to celebrate it, however, as both a pious holiday and a time for revelry. In his Poor Richard's Almanac of 1739, Philadelphian Benjamin Franklin wrote of Christmas, "O blessed season, loved by saints and sinners for long devotions or for longer dinners." So Christmas was finally accepted at that time? No. Anti-Christmas sentiment flared up again around the time of the American Revolution. Colonial New Englanders began to associate Christmas with royal officialdom and refused to mark it as a holiday. Even after the U.S. Constitution came into effect, the Senate assembled on Christmas Day in 1797, as did the House in 1802. It was only in the following decades that disdain for the holiday slowly ebbed away. Clement Clark Moore's poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, also known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, was published in New York in 1823 to enormous success. In 1836, Alabama became the first state to declare Christmas a public holiday, and other states soon followed suit. But New England remained defiantly Scrooge-like as late as 1850. Schools and markets remained open on Christmas Day. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow finally noted a transition state about Christmas in New England in 1856. The old Puritan feeling prevents it from being a cheerful, hearty holiday, though every year makes it more so, he wrote. Christmas Day was formally declared a federal holiday by President Ulysses S. Grant in 1870. And the footnote column here to the briefing section is entitled The War on the Christmas Tree. German settlers decorated Christmas trees in Pennsylvania in the early 18th century, but it took time for the custom to catch on in the rest of the country, where the tree was seen as a symbol of pagan idolatry. In Ohio, it was not until 1851 that a German pastor, the Reverend Heinrich Christian Schwann, dared to put a decorated tree inside his Cleveland church. His act was met with local outrage. The tree, said one newspaper, was a nonsensical, asinine, moronic absurdity. The editors castigated Lutherans for groveling before a shrub. Schwann was forced to take it down, but the following year he convinced community leaders to relent by arguing that the Christmas tree was a long-held Christian tradition in his native country. Yet the concerns he encountered persisted among Christians well into the 20th century. They point to Jeremiah 10, verses 1 through 4, which condemns the vanity of cutting down a tree from the forest and decorating it with silver and gold. In 1991, theologian Dr. Ernest L. Martin wrote, "The modern Christmas tree is a prime example in our day of what the heathen were doing in the time of Jeremiah." Now, in the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S., and the first one is entitled A Costly Marriage Crisis, and it was written by Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Marriage is rapidly becoming obsolete for half of our society, said Ruth Marcus. Only 51% of Americans over the age of 18 are now married, compared with almost 75% 50 years ago. Marriage remains popular among the better off and better educated, but the working class and the poor are now choosing to cohabit, often in a series of troubled short-term relationships. Two-thirds of college graduates are married, compared with less than half of those whose education ended after or during high school. And those with college and postgraduate educations now tend to marry each other rather than, say, their secretaries. Not surprisingly, the incomes of these well-educated married professionals are soaring far beyond those of the non-married, whose unions are often unstable. More troubling still is that this phenomenon is grimly self-perpetuating. Two-thirds of kids born to unmarried parents see them split up, and the kids raised in these chaotic homes also fail to get good educations and to marry as adults. Getting married isn't a magic bullet solution to economic inequality. But if the marriage rate continues to decline, the gap between the haves and the have-nots will continue to grow. The next column is entitled, How Colleges Discriminate Against Asians, and it was written by Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Why are so many Asian American students checking white on their college applications? Asked Rich Lowry. They figured out that our nation's universities, supposedly the most tolerant places on earth, routinely discriminate against Asians in admitting new students. A study by the Center for Equal Opportunity found that a black student with a 1240 SAT score and a 3.2 GPA had a 92% chance of being admitted to the University of Michigan, which uses racial preferences in its admissions policies. A white student with the same score had a 14% chance of getting in, while an Asian student had a mere 10% chance. It's somewhat understandable to favor black applicants over whites as a tiny belated step toward righting a historic injustice. But why punish Asian Americans with their famously diligent study habits and high test scores? Simple. Asians can and sometimes do make up 40% of the student body at top universities, so to achieve diversity of a crude sort, many of them are turned away. Call that affirmative action if you like, but its real name is bigotry. And the next column is entitled An Epidemic of Pointless Sharing by Timothy Egan in the NewYorkTimes.com. Every week, someone else voluntarily destroys their career or reputation on Twitter or Facebook, said Timothy Egan. The latest act of digital self-immolation was committed 2 weeks ago by three young aides to Representative Rick Larson, a Democrat from Washington, who used personal Twitter accounts to tell people how cool it was to be on the taxpayer's dime while drinking Jack Daniels, watching Nirvana videos, and avoiding their idiot boss. Naturally, they've now been fired, with their stupidity and laziness preserved forever on the Internet. Just one Google search away. To be fair, young people today are no more moronic or impulsive than the knuckleheads of yore, me for example, but they now have the ability to broadcast their most foolish moments to the world via social media. Indeed, the compulsive, promiscuous sharing facilitated by these tools makes banal idiots of all who use them. Consider the brilliant urban designer I follow on Twitter who recently felt a need to tweet, "Just had the best burrito of my life and stuck in traffic. OMG, this light is long." As 2011 draws to a close, let the counter-revolution begin. Please stop sharing. And now we'll flip to the back of the magazine to the popular column entitled The Last Word. That's the main title anyway. The specific title for this week's edition of The Last Word is The Mystery of Expertise. There is a chasm between what the brain knows, says David Eagleman, and what our minds can fathom. Consider the simple act of changing lanes while driving a car. Try this. Close your eyes, grip an imaginary steering wheel, and go through the motions of a lane change. Imagine that you are driving in the left lane and you would like to move over to the right lane. Before reading, actually go ahead and try it. It's a fairly easy task, right? I'm guessing that you held the steering wheel straight, then banked it over to the right for a moment, and then straightened it out again. No problem. Like almost everyone else, you got it completely wrong. The motion of turning the wheel rightward for a bit, then straightening it out again, would steer you off the road. You just piloted a course from the left lane onto the sidewalk. The correct motion for changing lanes is banking the wheel to the right, then back through the center, and continuing to turn the wheel just as far to the left side, and only then straightening it out. Don't believe it? Verify it for yourself when you're next in the car. It's such a simple task that you have no problem accomplishing it in your daily driving, but when forced to access it consciously, you're flummoxed. The lane-changing example is one of a thousand. You are not consciously aware of the vast majority of your brain's ongoing activities, nor would you want to be. It would interfere with the brain's well-oiled processes. The best way to mess up your piano piece is to concentrate on your fingers. The best way to get out of breath is to think about your breathing. And the best way to miss the golf ball is to analyze your swing. Remembering motor acts like changing lanes is a type of implicit memory, which means that your brain holds knowledge of something that your mind cannot explicitly access. Riding a bike, tying your shoes, typing on a keyboard, and steering your car into a parking space while speaking on your cell phone are examples of all of this. You execute these actions easily, but without knowing the details of how you do it. You would be totally unable to describe the perfectly timed choreography with which your muscles contract and relax as you navigate around other people in a cafeteria while holding a tray. Yet you have no trouble doing it. This is the gap between what your brain can do and what you can tap into consciously. To the extent that consciousness is useful, it is useful in small quantities and for very particular kinds of tasks. It's easy to understand why you would not want to be consciously aware of the intricacies of your muscle movement. But this can be less intuitive when applied to your perceptions, thoughts, and beliefs, which are also final products of the activity of billions of nerve cells. When chicken hatchlings are born, large commercial hatcheries usually set about dividing them into males and females. And the practice of distinguishing gender is known as chick sexing. Sexing is necessary because the two genders receive different feeding programs, one for the females, which will eventually produce eggs, and another for the males, which are typically destined to be disposed of. Only a few males are kept and fattened for meat. So the job of the thick sexer is to pick up each hatchling and quickly determine its sex in order to choose the correct bin to put it in. The problem is that the task is famously difficult. Male and female chicks look exactly alike. Well, almost exactly. The Japanese invented a method of sexing chicks known as vent sexing, by which experts could rapidly ascertain the sex of one-day-old hatchlings. Beginning in the 1930s, poultry breeders from around the world traveled to Zen Nippon Chick Sexing School in Japan to learn the technique. The mystery was that no one could explain exactly how it was done. It was somehow based on very subtle visual cues, but the professional sexers could not say what those cues were. They would look at the chick's rear, where the vent is, and simply seem to know the correct bin to throw it in. And this is how the professionals taught the student sexers. The master would stand over the apprentice and watch. The student would pick up a chick, examine its rear, and toss it into one bin or the other. The master would give feedback, yes or no. After weeks of this activity, the student's brain was trained to a masterful, albeit unconscious, level. Meanwhile, a similar story was unfolding oceans away. During World War II, under constant threat of bombings, the British had a great need to distinguish incoming aircraft quickly and accurately. Which aircraft were British planes coming home and which were German planes coming to bomb? Several airplane enthusiasts had proved to be excellent spotters, so the military eagerly employed their services. These spotters were so valuable that the government quickly tried to enlist more spotters, but they turned out to be rare and difficult to find. The government therefore asked the spotters to train up some others. It was a grim attempt. The spotters tried to explain their strategies, but failed. No one got it, not even the spotters themselves. Like the chicken sexers, the spotters had little idea how they did what they did. They simply saw the right answer. With a little ingenuity, the British finally figured out how to successfully train new spotters by trial and error feedback. A novice would hazard a guess, and an expert would say yes or no. Eventually, the novices became like their mentors, vessels of the mysterious, ineffable expertise. There can be a large gap between knowledge and awareness. When we examine skills that are not amenable to introspection, the first surprise is that implicit memory is completely separable from explicit memory. You can damage one without hurting the other. That's implicit memory versus explicit memory. Consider patients with anti-retrograde amnesia who cannot consciously recall new experiences in their lives. If you spend an afternoon trying to teach them the video game Tetris, they will tell you the next day that they have no recollection of the experience, that they have never seen this game before, and most likely that they have no idea who you are either. But if you look at their performance on the game the next day, you'll find that they have improved exactly as much as non-amnesiacs. Implicitly, their brains have learned the game. The knowledge is simply not accessible to their consciousness. Of course, it's not just sexers and spotters and amnesiacs who enjoy unconscious learning. Essentially, everything about your interaction with the world rests on this process. You may have a difficult time putting into words the characteristics of your father's walk, or the shape of his nose, or the way he laughs. But when you see someone who walks, looks, or laughs the way he does, you know it immediately. One of the most impressive features of brains, and especially human brains, is the flexibility to learn almost any kind of task. Give an apprentice the desire to impress his master in a chicken-sexing task, and his brain devotes its massive resources to distinguishing males from females. Give an unemployed aviation enthusiast a chance to be a national hero, and his brain learns to distinguish enemy aircraft from local flyboys. This flexibility of learning accounts for a large part of what we consider human intelligence. While many animals are properly called intelligent, humans distinguish themselves in that they are so flexibly intelligent, fashioning their neural circuits to match the task at hand. It is for this reason that we can colonize every region on the planet, learn the local language we're born into, and master skills as diverse as playing the violin, high jumping, and operating the space shuttle. On December 31, 1974, Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas was debilitated by a stroke that paralyzed his left side and confined him to a wheelchair. But Justice Douglas demanded to be checked out of the hospital and on the grounds that he was fine. He declared that reports of his paralysis were a myth. When reporters expressed skepticism, he invited them to join him for a hike, a move interpreted as absurd. He even claimed to be kicking football field goals with his paralyzed leg. As a result of this apparently delusional behavior, Douglas lost his seat on the Supreme Court. What Douglas experienced is called agnosnosia. The term describes a total lack of awareness about an impairment. It's not that Justice Douglas was lying. His brain actually believed that he could move just fine. But shouldn't the contradicting evidence alert those with anosognosia to a problem? It turns out that alerting the system to contradictions relies on particular brain regions, especially one called the anterior cingulate cortex. Because of these conflict monitoring regions, incompatible ideas will result in one side or another's winning. The brain either constructs a story that makes them compatible or ignores one side of the debate. In special circumstances of brain damage, this arbitration system can be damaged, and then conflict can cause no trouble to the conscious mind. On August 20, 1974, in a game between the California Angels and the Detroit Tigers, Guinness World's Record clocked Nolan Ryan's fastball at 100.9 miles per hour. If you work the numbers, you'll see that Ryan's pitch departs the mound and crosses home plate 60 feet 6 inches away in 0.4 seconds. This gives just enough time for light signals from the baseball to hit the batter's eye, work through the circuitry of the retina, activate successions of cells along the loopy superhighways of the visual system at the back of the head, cross vast territories to the motor areas, and modify the contraction of the muscles swinging the bat. Amazingly, this entire sequence is possible in less than 0.4 seconds. Otherwise, no one would ever hit a fastball. But even more surprising is that conscious awareness takes longer than that, about half a second. So the ball travels too rapidly for batters to be consciously aware of it. One does not need to be consciously aware to perform sophisticated motor acts. You can notice this when you begin to duck from a snapping tree branch before you are aware that it's coming toward you, or when you're already jumping up when you first become aware of a phone's ring. The conscious mind is not at the center of the action in the brain. Instead, it is far out on a distant edge, hearing but whispers of the activity. As Carl Jung put it, in each of us, there is another whom we do not know. As Pink Floyd put it, there's someone in my head, but it's not me. That article was copyrighted 2011 by David Eagleman, reprinted with the courtesy of Pantheon Books, a division of Random House. And now from The Week magazine, we'll turn to a special feature of this final edition of The Week magazine for 2011. It's entitled Poll Watch, and the specific title is The Way We Were in 2011. The sputtering economy left us feeling fed up and disengaged, but at least we could escape online. How are we feeling? Pretty pessimistic. In August, 73% of Americans said that the country was on the wrong track, the highest level in 3 years, and 47% thought the worst was yet to come in the economic crisis. 95% are worried that the country will slip into another recession, while 39% fear the U.S. economy is in a permanent decline. 76% say the country's economic structure favors the wealthy. And 48% think that while the American dream, work hard and you'll get ahead, once held true, it doesn't anymore. That grim outlook may explain why belief in American exceptionalism is waning. Only 49% of Americans now agree with the statement that our culture is superior to others, which 60% thought was true only back in 2002. Who is to blame for this mess? Well, 30% say Wall Street is responsible for America's economic ills, but many more, 64%, point the finger at big government. 81% are satisfied with how the country is being governed, and 57% have little or no confidence that the federal government can solve America's problems. That doesn't mean they don't want Congress to try. 60% say Washington should attempt to reduce the growing gap between rich and poor. And 75% want millionaires to pay more in taxes. But 53% also believe that government should be downsized. One thing most people can agree on is that they are tired of protesters. Only 35% have a positive view of Occupy Wall Street, while just 29% think well of the Tea Party. Is there anything that we're enthusiastic about? Well, 58% say Osama bin Laden's death made them happy, and 61% believe that the Al-Qaeda leader is now in hell. On a personal level, we're surprisingly pleased with our bodies, although more than 68% of Americans are overweight or obese. Only 39% would call themselves overweight, and 56% describe their weight as just about right. How has society changed? Well, we're increasingly tolerant. 86% approve of marriages between whites and blacks, up from 4% back in 1958. For the first time in 7 years of tracking, a majority of Americans, 53%, support making same-sex marriage legal. 56% consider gay or lesbian relationships morally acceptable. And 59% supported the repeal of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. 62% say it wouldn't make a difference in their voting choice if a presidential candidate were gay. And 68% wouldn't mind if a candidate were a Mormon. But 61% say they'd find it hard to vote for an atheist. And finally, how do we enjoy ourselves? Well, more and more we find pleasure online. On any given day, 58% go online for no other reason than to have fun or pass the time. And 37% turn to the Internet to help diagnose their illnesses. 65% visit social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter, but 7% have gotten in trouble at school or work, and 7% think they've lost a potential job because of a comment or a picture they shared online. Nonetheless, 27% of men and 23% of women say they have been photographed nude, and 16% have used their cell phones for sexting, sending naked photos or erotic messages to a partner. The fun and games aren't limited to partners, however. 31% of men and 26% of women admit to contacting an ex via Facebook or email. In a world where everyone is connected, trust doesn't come easily. 41% of men and 47% of women have suspected their partners of cheating. So, depending on how you look at that, you can figure out how we actually were in 2011. Now, with the time we have left, we will turn to the section of the Week magazine entitled Talking Points. The first item is Christopher Hitchens, A Combative Writer's Complex Legacy. I once called Christopher Hitchens the greatest living essayist in the English language, said Christopher Buckley in NewYorker.com, and I would alter only one word in that blurb now. Hitchens, who died last week at age 62 of esophagus cancer, was probably the most vigorous and distinctive voice in our public discourse of recent decades, and certainly one of its most colorful characters. A legendary drinker, smoker, and bon vivant, Hitchens had stamina that was as epic as his erudition and wit. And he could churn out yards of glittering, immaculate prose with a blood alcohol level that would send most of us to the emergency room. Hitchens was certainly a character, said Stephen Carter in Bloomberg.com, but what made him so remarkable was his devotion to clarity of thought and his brilliantly polished language. He once described Osama bin Laden as a man of strange, scrofulous, quasi-nobility and bogus spirituality. A visit to North Korea produced this succinct summary. Newspapers with no news, shops with no goods, an airport with almost no planes. Sarah Palin, he said, was a proud, boastful ignoramus. While of Glenn Beck's 2010 Tea Party rally on the National Mall, he wrote, "The overall effect was large, vague, moist, and undirected, the water world of white self-pity." Hitchens hated bullies, said Katha Pollitt in The Nation, but he could also be one. He wrote and spoke with a testosterone and booze-fueled certainty that left no room for nuance or doubt. Whether denouncing Mother Teresa as a thieving, fanatical Albanian dwarf, or opining after the death of the Reverend Jerry Falwell that if you gave Falwell an enema, you could bury him in a matchbox. Hitchens certainly was entertaining, but he embodied the kind of black-and-white thinking that inevitably leads to folly. And I never forgave my former colleague for his dismissive contempt for feminism. His attacks on religion were also mean-spirited, said Robert Smith in AmericanThinker.com. Hitchens was the most aggressive and least respectful of the so-called new atheists, and his book, God Is Not Great, was a masterpiece of arrogance and intellectual snobbery, in which he sneeringly dismissed all religions and spiritual belief as superstitious baloney. For all the scorn Hitchens dumped on religion, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times, it was remarkable how much religious believers liked him. Perhaps that's because we always had the sense that Hitchens was not so much a disbeliever as a rebel, that his atheism was at heart a political romantic's attempt to pick a fight with the biggest tyrant he could find. For those of us who shared in Hitchens' lack of faith, said Daniel Dennett in WashingtonPost.com, he was a true inspiration. While Hitch could build a logical argument against religion like no one else, he also refused to treat the pious and their irrational beliefs with any special respect. When faced with monstrous fraud, Hitch knew sometimes rudeness is called for. Now, as we reach the end of our program here, a couple of short items. Almost one in three Americans has been arrested for a crime other than a traffic violation by the age of 23, according to a new study of 7,335 young people. The 30% arrest rate, sociologists said, reflects a more aggressive societal attitude toward such crimes as vandalism, underage drinking, drunken driving, shoplifting, and drug possession. Elevator accidents kill about 27 people each year in the U.S. About 10,200 injuries are reported. And our poll watch for this week, President Obama's job approval ratings are improving following his call to raise taxes on millionaires to help the middle class and his stepped-up rhetorical attacks on Republicans. 49% now approve of the job he's doing, an increase of 5 percentage points in just 1 month. 50% say they trust Obama to protect the middle class, while 35% say they trust Republicans to do so. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.